All right. Last week was amazing. You know, we were able to drop an announcement in the early part of February about the Federation Klingon tactical campaign release. Last week, we were able to start picking it apart and dissecting the book pretty much page by page, chapter by chapter, section by section. And we are continuing this week. I'm of course, Michael Dismuke. I am a blogger on Continuing Missions, which is the number one fan site for Star Trek Adventures RPG and Captain's Log. I'm a freelance writer for STA and lead writer for Captain's Log. And we're going to also, again, like in the former weeks, we are going to have a guest host who's going to take a lead on the question because he was the lead writer on Captain's Log. But before we introduce him, let's, of course, introduce the captain of our ship, Jim Johnson.
Hey, everybody. Jim Johnson. I am the project manager and line editor for the Star Trek Adventures RPG and the Captain's Log solo RPG, both published by Modiphius Entertainment, going on 8 years strong, 120-odd episodes of this podcast, which is super awesome. Who knew that we'd still be doing this? And we've got all these great new products coming out and got probably another 120 more episodes to come. We'll see. Fingers crossed, right? Keep on keeping on. I'm really excited. We got two guests with us here tonight to talk about this new book. I got, and I'll have them introduce themselves, of course, as we do. And our guest host tonight is the lead writer on the Klingon War, the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign, Al Spader.
How's it going, everyone? Al Spader. I'm a freelance writer. I've been working for Star Trek Adventures for a couple of years now. Super excited to be the lead writer on this project and can't wait to see what everyone does with it.
Awesome. Thank you, Al. And back once again, many time visitor to our podcast here, the resident science dude and starships guy for the vast majority of the products that we've done over the last 8 years, Aaron Pollier.
Hi. Yep. Hi, everybody. I'm Aaron Pollier. Yep. Long time freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures. I'm really happy to be here. I helped Al on a lot of the little bits here in the campaign book. Mm-hmm.
For sure. All right. So without more ado, Al, I think I'm going to turn this boat over to you. We're going to be talking all about the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign, Chapter 2. Take it away, sir.
Thank you so much, Jim. First things first, because Aaron's here. Aaron did help on he probably added something to every single chapter in the book, just about. We are going to focus on chapter 2, and then we'll get into a little bit of chapter 7 towards the end as well that Aaron helped with. But I do want to have a general discussion with all of you about chapter 2, which is the game mastering the campaign chapter. This chapter is designed, so the first chapter was designed for the players with player options, and this chapter is designed to help guide a new game master or a game master that's been doing this for a long time through how to implement a war type story and the tactical overlay at the same time. So it starts with a little bit about session zero and a safety checklist. We felt that it was really, really important when putting this together to give groups an opportunity to sign consent forms, see what part of the war they're into and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, what do you guys think about a session zero during a wartime story?
You know, I was thinking, you know, I in the player's guide and the game master's guide, I had the privilege to talk about session zero, but this one is way different. And the reason why is because we're talking straight war. And so this is a very sensitive subject. And I was loving the fact that at the end of the book, you actually included a safety checklist out. So I want to point out to people that this is the only publication with Star Trek Adventures that has a has the safety checklist, which is good for any game you're playing. Really well laid out. And I want people to be super sensitive because we all come from a lot of different backgrounds. And when you have a lot of people sitting at the table, their experience with war, their experience with family who's been in war, their experience maybe being related to or friends with refugees, these are heavy subjects. And so to me, the safety checklist was one of the best boons of this book that will apply to every single STA games going forward.
Yeah, I do want to point out that Allison Saib wrote all of the Session Zero and safety checklist stuff.
Wonderful.
They went through and actually did a really neat job of taking the typical lines and veils that you'd be used to and kind of like shifting it to a Star Trek mindset. Adapting like what would the X card look like for STA and things like that. So she did a great job there. I was excited that she was a part of that.
Aaron, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I also thought it was a really good idea. Michael said pretty much everything that I wanted to say with it. It was really good to see that just because when thinking about war, and you know, I've talked about how I'm a historical reenactor, that I often have to encounter a lot of these difficult parts of war, and having difficulty talking about it with the general public, just because a lot of people are sensitive about it, for good reason. And so having this kind of checklist there right away and have it all out in the open for everyone at the table is just a fantastic idea.
Yeah, I think when we did the Player's Guide and the Game Master Guide, I really wanted to have a checklist in there. We just ran out of time and ran out of space. So I kind of put it as a little bookmark on the side of my notes saying, if there's another book that comes down the road that we can do a checklist in, make sure to do it. And this felt like the right one. And, Alan, Allison, y'all did a great job pulling it all together. And, we added that little veneer to Lines and Veils and X cards to make it a little more Star Trek-y, right? We didn't have to do that because I think Lines and Veils are pretty much standard language across most of the RPG, meta space, as it were. But, Al, in response to your question, I think a Session Zero is super important for any game, right? Any kind of campaign, really, not just a wartime game, but any game, but especially for wartime. Because like, even if you're in a group that you've been gaming with for years and years and years and decades, that there may still be stuff that people have never really talked about that might come up in a game that they might be uncomfortable with. Like I think about my two best friends who I've been gaming with for 30 odd years. There were questions on that checklist that I couldn't remember ever coming up in one of our game sessions, like whatever game we were playing. And I don't actually know. It's like, oh, would that bother them? I don't know, because it never came up. And did it never come up because they don't want to do it, so it's not in their games? Or did it just not come up because it just wasn't something that we were working on? So I think it's always worth it to check in with everybody, even if you think you know the people really well. And especially if you don't know them really well, but even if you think you know them pretty well, it never hurts to just check in.
Yeah, I recall watching the Center Seat 55 Years of Star Trek, that documentary. I don't know if you've all seen it, but there was this point where in shooting and writing Undiscovered Country, Star Trek VI, Gene Roddenberry was quite upset by his original characters being racist toward the Klingons. And that had actually become an issue while writing it. And you think like, well, this is a story. You can write whatever you want. These are the main characters. But that was something Nicholas Meyer, who wrote the screenplay, had to face off. So we can't make assumptions. As I was watching that documentary, I was like, oh, that's a good point. Like, these are things they should have got over by this time. So that checklist, Al and Allison, who did fantastic work on it, is kind of key. Like, don't make assumptions. Some people play Star Trek for a particular reason, and a war campaign can bring out the worst of humanity as opposed to the best, which is the reason some people play Star Trek.
Yeah, and let's not forget that we also, during the Session Zero, need to decide, are we using the tactical overlay? Are we doing all of the mission briefs? Like, what is it that you're into as we are telling the story? So a very, very cool section there. I think a lot of people would get good use out of it. That said, the lines and veils in there, the sheet can be printed off for any game. It doesn't just have to be the tactical war campaign. Keep that in mind, print it off whenever you're starting a new session with some new players, use that tool. We then move into the planning the campaign section of the chapter. So this is really talking about how do we tell the stories, how do we tell the scripted events, and how do those interlink with the campaign overlay. But we figured we would front load right away some of the historical stuff that has been happening to lead up to the war. Because at this point, the Klingons, we haven't really encountered them for some time. So I'm curious, between the events that we saw in Enterprise season 4 and Discovery season 1, what do you think that the Klingons have been doing and whatnot? Aaron, you want to jump in on that?
There's a lot of openness to that part of the timeline. To me, if it was just me, I would talk about how the augment virus really shook the Empire as the people that were infected by it became kind of second class citizens in a way, being seen as less Klingon and used as cannon fodder. And that's why we end up seeing them in TOS so much as like the front of the Klingons, that they're the ones that are kind of being sent out to deal with the Federation because they can also infiltrate a little better. But also there's a reason why the houses have fractured and started warring with each other. So it also probably stems back to these fault lines that came from the augment virus, that some houses felt like they were more pure and they tried to become pure, so to speak.
Yeah, I think the pieces like there's clues all throughout the first season, right, where all the different houses are kind of warring with each other and scheming with each other and aligning with each other or disaligning with each other. It made me feel like it was like a big game of diplomacy, right? Like some are working together until it was the appropriate time to backstab you for honor or glory or whatever. It's just a lot of stuff going on, a lot of instability, I think, in the Empire, where you've got different houses competing with each other. Who knows what the High Council's like? That's probably just a melee every meeting, right? It's just random people trying to take command and take over and scheming and all kinds of stuff going on. So, like Aaron said, though, I think it's, if you want to play a Klingon campaign, I mean, really any kind of campaign in that time period, you could do all kinds of stuff with it. Maybe even poured in some of the rules from some of the other 2D20 games. Like, I don't know, I'm not that familiar with Dune, but yes. I think all that political machinations would totally find a place in here if you're Klingon, just to kind of set the stage.
Yeah, you said diplomacy, Jim, and I was like, after I looked at the Dune 2D20 rule books, because yeah, I'm such a lover of Trek, after I read the book, I was like, oh my God, I could use this as my Klingon houses. Like, it's totally in line with a lot of what was going on there. So I really love how Aaron talked about who was frontline and back. I would, if I was playing this as a Klingon campaign, in addition to the skirmishes, my tactical would be like, how are these houses being maneuvered?
I also would think that the chancellor, the head of the great houses, would be very weak in the lead up to the Klingon war, just because that cohesion just isn't there. So maybe there's a figurehead, and that's where a lot of this politicking is going on between the great houses of who can we put there that's just a face that's covering for whatever scheme that we have personally as our great house. But yeah, a weak chancellor might be a big deal there.
Yeah, and absolutely, a lot of times when civilizations throughout history have gotten to this point, a lot of people turn to spirituality and religion and type stuff. And Tecumseh was almost like that spiritual leader at the start of the war that brought everyone together. So excellent. We also talk briefly in there about presenting your scripted events that happened during the campaign. So at the beginning and end of each of the three campaign phases, we have major events from the TV show that are read out. What this recommends is maybe you don't just read it to the players every single time. Maybe you, give it to a single player on the bridge, because their friend has messaged them that this event has happened, things like that. So just to keep it fresh, instead of just having, Admiral, so-and-so on the screen presenting the data, to everyone, like, hey, Discovery is destroyed. Like, have that happen through another channel. Like, maybe it's a friend passing it on or a family member passing it on, so on and so forth. And that leads us to a pretty cool section about the types of missions that you could run. Now, we've provided 6 full missions and I think 24 mission briefs that you can dig into over the course of the campaign. But if you want to do your own missions set in this timeline, we give you kind of like a little overview of like covert operations, military defense, rescue missions, peacekeeping, diplomacy, and so on. And I wanted to kind of get you guys' idea about like, why is it important to have not just the pew pew type missions, but to also include some of these more, I would guess, Starfleet like missions where you are trying to use diplomacy to get other people on board with your war effort, et cetera, et cetera.
I can say something about that, I guess. I mean, Starfleet, while they are military, they're still trying to do what their charter says, which is seek out new life and new civilizations. And as the Federation is a Federation, doing diplomacy means bringing people in on your side of the conflict instead of perhaps being absorbed by the Klingons without a fight. And it's, you look at World War II, the US and the UK and the Soviet Union had other nations that they had diplomacy with in order to either keep out of the fight or to come in on our side. Even the Axis did that to an extent. Those kinds of missions are incredibly important.
Yeah, I'll add 2 thoughts. One is just like, look to history, right? And this is kind of related to what Aaron was saying. Like, one of the fascinating things I discovered or was reminded about when I was doing some research on the Civil War, the American Civil War, is that, even though it was a brutal war and like the entire nation was completely consumed by it, the U.S. government was still doing other stuff, right? Like, that wasn't directly related to the war. They were still, pushing the boundaries of the states out into the West and the Pacific Northwest, and having negotiations with other countries and doing stuff in the meantime, fighting this internal war, right? So you got to have that. I mean, there's always more things going on, and the Federation is big, right? Even in this time period, it's a big organization, and while the war is hard and important, obviously, and the Klingons are kicking their butts all over the place, they're still doing other things because you have to, right? Until you can't anymore. So that's one piece of it. And then from a purely practical standpoint, from a group of players and game masters, like having done a war campaign in one of my campaigns back in the day, introducing a war into a campaign, it gets really boring to do the pew pew shooty stuff all the time. And my players like really needed some variety. They're like, we like getting into combat and we like having the fights and stuff, but that's not Star Trek all the time, right? Doing it in little bits and bobs here and there is good, but we need more variety. We need different kinds of stories. We want some positivity. Well, give us a diplomacy mission, give us a rescue mission, give us an escort mission, give us something different so that we have a broader scope to the war, so that we're just not, blasting away every episode, because it can get exhausting.
You can actually build a lot of excitement too for non-pew pew games if you're players eventually know this is going to come back and they actually can help me. Maybe it's a person they meet. Maybe it's an asset they collect. Maybe it's a technology they discover. Maybe it's a key they got that they don't know they're just sitting on. And I know we've done that, Al and Aaron, we play for how many years now? And I literally think everything has meaning. I'm going to go back to this. And at some point they're going to go, wait a second. And so that way, when it's not pew pew, they're excited. They know that this is playing into the campaign. And of course, the number one thing when you're not pew pew is you're developing characters, you're building relationships so that the characters, in my opinion, fall in love with each other. So when you do get to the pew pew, they're protecting each other. They value each other. There's so much character development that's rich because those pew pew moments go by so fast. But you really want people to be in love with each other, their characters, and all the clues they're picking up in a campaign of this scope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes back to what we call stakes, right? Right. And if the stakes are that you care about your crew, I think that's a really big thing when you're telling a war story. Jim, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I was just gonna add something that Michael said as a nice little game master trick is like even if the players pick up an asset or something and maybe you don't know where it fits in, you just kind of hold on to it and then somewhere down the road introduce it and say, oh yeah, I planned that all along. I planted those seeds early on and here it is. So you just
be a little
sneaky and then they look back after they'll look back in a year, right? And they'll go, oh, it all came together so nicely. It was so well planned. And you're like, yeah. Sure was.
Do you guys ever think that I actually craft my campaigns that well? Or I hope, I do exactly what Jim says sometimes, just so you all know.
Oh yeah, no, that has to be it. I mean, like you can only plan so far and then the characters are going to take the story in their own way. So you just have to kind of roll with it. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, not to say that other games don't do this, but I think that's one of the real powers that I've discovered over the years of Star Trek Adventures, just listening to how other players are playing it, where I've gotten away from doing the like just using pre-built missions. I just love giving like a kickoff point for the players and then just see what they do with it, right? And just kind of like hang back and like prompt them from time to time and just see where they go with it, because it's always going to be better than what I could have come up with on my own. And I haven't found something quite like that in the different game system or setting, and as far as I'm concerned, it's unique to Star Trek, but I'm sure somebody else will say otherwise. But I just love that process of discovery for game sessions and just storytelling with the group.
Michael, you had something to add?
Yeah, I just want to say I want to encourage people, as you're playing this campaign or any campaign, if during the campaign your characters invent something cool, stumble across something cool, have a cool backstory they wrote, or they interact with an NPC in a way you didn't think they would, and maybe you only planned that minor NPC or notable NPC to be in that one story, but if there's some sort of visceral reaction they have with that character, that's called a guest star that I make sure to bring back. My greatest antagonists have been ones like, oh, they're really riffing off this person. Okay. I'm going to have to work into this, So encourage you all. You're all going to have different experiences. Don't emulate each other. But when you see your players get viscerally affected by something positive or negative, bring that back. And that creates a great, story.
Yeah. And Michael, that ties right into the chapters that we wrote. In fact, I think you may have written them in the Game Master Guide or the Player's Guide where, we're encouraging the players and the game masters to be writers, right? Be put yourself in the mindset of the writers of the TV show. Like I can guarantee, in fact, we've read plenty of instances where writers will say, okay, we wrote this character for this one episode and wow, it came off really, really good. And we just loved the way they interacted with the other characters and the actors had a great, back and forth. Let's bring him back or her back. And then, so that's how Kai Winn and Dukat and Damar, that's how these characters keep coming back because the writers wrote great stuff and the actors did great stuff with it. And the fans, of course, the fans responded to it. And then, the producers or whatever say, oh, we should bring that character back if we can. So do that in your show. If you see your players vibing off something that you thought was just a throwaway, minor NPC or something, give that character some more life and see what happens.
Excellent. So so from there, we kind of start talking about points of interest. Now, the tactical overlay has four types of point of interest that you might need to address with one of your assets. They are tactical points of interest, exploration points of interest, routine points of interest, and unknown points of interest. And so these four different concepts make us believe that there are certain things we should be doing or certain types of missions that appear when we're doing them. So, for example, if you're talking about an exploration point of interest, it's probably going to lean more towards a scientific survey, things like that. But that's not always the case, right? If we are doing a tactical type point of interest for the campaign, yeah, there's probably going to be some military assets there, but it doesn't always have to be that way, right? We could just tactically have to secure like a choke point, or tactically secure a supply of resources or something like that. So I was wondering what you guys thought of just these different types of stories that can be told at each of the different points of interest.
I think tactical doesn't necessarily, well, like you said, it doesn't necessarily mean like combat, but it means more urgent. So like you can be tactically doing a diplomatic mission. It's just that, hey, it's out there in the front line. This is time sensitive. We really need to get this planet to join up with the Federation and allow us to base starships there. Something like that. So tactical just means more urgent, where routine means a little less urgent, but it gives a little more a broader road for the characters to actually go down rather than a very directed approach.
Yeah, I mean, having play tested this, I won't talk too much about it until we get to the next chapter, next week's episode, but tactical, I found, was not just explosions. People, sometimes it was just get information on this, because later on that's going to provide you an asset to have an advantage in maybe another for another ship or another fleet engagement. So it really expanded my mind, like what tactics look like, even if it's planting a sensor buoy as a spy ware, so that if the Klingons do come over the border, you capture them. So really, all of these, you know, again, I'll get into it next episode. Super exciting, especially when you're rolling on a random table to decide what your missions are.
Mm. Yeah, great stuff. 2 points. I love tactical because it made me think about chess, and it made me think about how you can be playing so many different types of games while you're playing chess. You could be doing like all out tactical. You could be trying to outthink your opponent. You could be trying to strategize. And I can see like there'd be all kinds of diplomatic and political things tied into tactical, where, you know, in this case, maybe you are trying to secure an alliance with an alien species before the Klingons do, or before the Klingons attack them. Or maybe you're just trying to outpace somebody else, not in a pew pew kind of way, but just in kind of like a diplomacy talky kind of like, we're going to make a better negotiation than the other ones do. And the reason we're doing this is tactical, because that'll free up this section of the, you know, our left flank, and it'll give us a little bit of security here, and that'll help us over here on the other side. And, you know, there's just all kinds of, you know, machinations and strategizing that you can do that are, you know, tactical, but aren't necessarily, you know, ships going at each other or sending down regiments onto a planet to take it over, right? Yeah. The second thing I wanted to say was, I, as a game master, I'm a big fan of frameworks. Like I love more tools in my toolbox, and just these four points of interest, like, even though this is only like 2 pages or a page and a half in this book, like I could easily see some creative game masters and players taking this and just blowing it out and expanding it even further, and then just deluging Michael with continuing mission articles and supplements and additional bits and bobs just to build on each of these components. Because that's what they are. Like, it was making me think about the plot components that we did back in the day in the Three Division source books, right? And this is just another way of adding another framework and another set of tools. And I tell you, I there are days I wish I was just a game master, so I could just sit back and just write all this cool stuff and get the framework out of my head and just add more meat onto this. But I'll, you know, obviously we'll leave that to the fans to do that. But yeah, I'm just excited at this. Like when I saw this draft, I was like, oh, more tools. I love it. So just really excited for it.
Yeah, I'm just encouraging people, watch next week's show, because I'm holding back talking about practical application of these points of interest. But watch next week's show, because I will be a lot more verbose about how I use this in my campaign that I play tested.
Awesome. And then we get into, so the Discovery campaign guide that came out 3 years ago had a ton of mission briefs and a three mission campaign in there. And a lot of them happened all around the time of the Federation Klingon War. So I kind of went through each of those and said how to adapt them to use during your campaign, along with what is what campaign stage, what point of interest, what happens if you succeed and fail. So if you need more stories, there's a whole nother book of them that you can pull from as you're going through the campaign. We do get into burnout a little bit, and talking about, you know, be mindful of your table, be mindful of your players, be mindful of what you're presenting to the players, and be flexible. Yeah, the campaign overlay, you know, you randomly are rolling things, but if you randomly roll, you know, a sentient comet for the fifth time, you know that your players are probably not going to be into that, right? So be flexible with what you roll and so on and so forth. And I think that you'll keep people engaged for a long time. And that leads us to Aaron's big section here, notable star systems. So when we first started throwing together the outline for this, Aaron mentioned, he's like, you know what would be really cool is if there was a notable star system for each faction that they could kind of use as a home base, a point that we are telling our story from. So, Aaron, do you want to get into your two points of interest? I mean, your two systems that you created?
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to make at least the two major star systems, and there's a couple little other systems that are mentioned in each area for the Federation and Klingon Empire. And I did want to make those as like playgrounds for the characters to really kind of make it their own. We don't see them in on television, so you can just do with them as you please. So the Federation is called Adelphus, and I wanted to showcase this idea of a world that's been clearly involved with what would become Federation members. So like it was basically a war ground between the Vulcans and the Romulans before the Federation even started, when they were playing their big chess game across the stars. So there's like a native species there. And then once the Earth Romulan War ended, it was brought into the Federation and as a protectorate. And so there's lots of Federation facilities there and Starfleet vessels. And I wanted to detail out the planets and moons that are in the system. So I gave them names and what they looked like, what how big they were, that kind of thing, just to give a lot of flavor, a lot of color there. I don't know if anybody has questions so far with what you've seen there. But yeah,
I have a comment with like anything you do, Aaron. I cut and paste this stuff into my games as much as I can possible for explanations. I know you did a lot of similar work on the Shackleton Expanse, and you know that I'll drag in chunks of it just because you explain it so much better than I can write it. So I encourage people, you don't have to do it exactly, but look at the language in there and wrap it into your games, because it really, you know, he creates such a rich tapestry of what the universe looks like.
Okay. And then there's like two uninhabited systems that the Federation uses. One's like a listening station, and another one is a scientific research outpost that is located in the system. And then with the Klingons, it's sort of the same pattern. I wanted to make an inhabited system that was invaded by the Klingon Empire and subjugated. So that's Matari Prime. Once again, the planets are detailed there and given a bit of color, so you can build out a campaign. And then a couple uninhabited systems. One's a fortress system, and another one is a system that was used by the Herc and abandoned as well. So that's where a lot of older Herc vessels are and being salvaged.
Yeah, that's awesome, Aaron. I mean, I love the names that you put on these things too, like the big ear for a listening station. Like that's just, it's just great. Like really puts a lot of flavor there. So awesome. So yeah, use these systems as your home base, your battlegrounds, your points of interest might happen here, et cetera, et cetera. We then spill into the optional rules section. So by default, the campaign is told from a Starfleet perspective, but Michael Duxbury went through and he's like, how can we adjust this for if you wanted to play an Admiralty game all the way through? How could we adapt this if we were putting it from a Klingon perspective? And then the war profiteering game. So if you're using like civilian, like Harry Mudd type characters, how could you, you know, find some ground in amidst a war? So, yeah, so those options are in there and how to convert this to your perspective, which is really, really cool. Then we get into mechanics. There's lots of different mechanic systems in here. I was going through the SRD, which is the system reference document for 2D20. And I was like, what haven't we included in Star Trek yet? And then a couple of them I created as well. So we put the optional reaction system in there and the optional initiative systems in there. Some people have had a hard time just understanding the openness of how initiative works in Star Trek Adventures. So these initiative variants might help make it feel a little bit more familiar to you, where you can either roll or you can have initiative set based off of your stats.
I was going to say, I just want to make sure you don't skip what I want to talk about ship power, all the ship stuff you put in.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to that. So the ship initiative is awesome, where the smaller ships get to act first. And Aaron and I went back and forth on this about 1.5 million times. And that can be adjusted based off of different talents that the ships have. And then we have how to break ties in ship initiative as well. The next page is like, this I think I would use all of this all of the time. I was thinking, like, if you want to do a mass ship combat, right? Like if you wanted to relive the Battle of the Binary Stars, how would we do that effectively? And as we were writing this book, the Homeworld RPG came out and they happened to have a section that said simplified multiple ship combat. I was like, ooh, let me see what's here and see if we can adapt it, because Homeworld does a lot of massive combats all the time. So it was basically taking crew qualities and adding them to ships. And then basically every one of your players just gets to control what that ship does. So you don't go into the minutiae of what each person is doing on the bridge of each ship. It's literally just activating and everybody controls their own ship, which is something that I've been looking for a while. So the rules for that are there. And then the other thing that we have been hearing a lot is, what does my engineer do during ship combat? Usually an engineer has to be fairly reactive, right? If there's a power loss or a breach or something like that. So I decided to create a ship power management system where you actually assign power to different systems. And each time that system would assist you on a task that you're doing, it uses a power from that system. I don't know if you guys read through those.
I actually have to say, that's my, out of this whole book, this is my favorite new rule that I'm going to be begging that you guys adapt into our game. Because STA originally, you know, with the power, to me, I'm a visual learner. I couldn't visually see where power was flowing on my ship. And this reminded me, and I never played it, but I think it was Fassa or Decipher, where they actually had some sort of power adjusters. Jim, do you remember? Or Aaron, do you remember what that was about?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the Fassa game.
Okay, I heard people describe it before, and I kind of like the fact that in order to do something, you have to adjust power or get power from here or there. And to me, that's such a Star Trek trope. And I was like, oh, we finally have a rule that symbolizes that trope of take power from engines and put it to weapons. And so, you know, I'll be asking the permission from my group in our continuing session zero if at some point we could actually incorporate this rule into our game. But I really think that this is one of the coolest rules in here.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. And that's kind of what I was trying to do, is you're taking power from one place, put it in another place. There is, and like if a system ever has zero power in it, it is offline. Now that doesn't mean that you can't use it to assist. It just increases the complication range when you're trying to do that thing. It definitely feels way more like you are always shifting power from one place to another. So if you're in engineering and you're looking for something to do, you literally have something to do every single turn by either generating power or shifting power from one system to the next. And then we finish up, we bring in, a lot of people have been asking about how do you do races and chases and pursuits? And that system Nathan has already created. And again, we found it in the system reference document for 2D20. So it was all about just how does this apply to Trek and how do we put the Trek lens over it? There's a couple of different ways you can do that in here, but there's a really cool system called Abstract Pursuit, where you're setting the distance between you and the person that you're chasing. You're setting how fast you're both going and so on and so forth. And this can happen at the ship level, or it could happen like if you're on the ground level and you're trying to catch up to an enemy, or you're trying to flee from an invading force, things like that. I think this system would be really, really helpful. And then last but not least, we get into like stealth and infiltration, something that we don't typically see a lot of when we're watching Star Trek. Every now and then, we see, somebody wearing their all black uniform or your tactical armor and things like that, trying to navigate a situation on the ground. But this is like really about how do you sneak around? How do you sense or detect people around you? When you're trying to do this tactical situation on a planet side.
Yeah, my advice to, again, people, you know, we've said it a lot in the show, is don't throw everything at your players at once with these new rules. Pick one or two to introduce and find the right module or mission brief where you can highlight it, because, you know, I know I like all of my players to have the rule set in front of them if we're trying something new for the first time. So a lot of goodies in here. Don't throw it all into one mission.
No, absolutely not.
And they're all optional rules, so don't feel like you have to use them, right? I mean, we're just throwing more goodies at you. Like, I mean, fortunately, that SRD came out somewhere in the development of this book, and it was a great opportunity to just cherry pick it. And I think, you know, Al and your team, you all did a great job of finding all the cool stuff. Because, like, you know, I like mechanics. I don't love mechanics. I just want to get to the narrative and get to the, you know, cut to the chase. And but I appreciate, you know, because I have to put the project manager hat on and say, oh yeah, this is good for the game. It's not good for me personally as a game master, but it's good for the game because it's just even more stuff that we're throwing at people and saying, hey, you know, if you want more detailed stealth rules, here you go. If you want more detailed chase kind of rules, here you go. If you want, and I love the homeworld mass combat stuff, because like anything that we can do to give the opportunity to do those big scale combats that we see sometimes in Star Trek, like the Dominion War and the Federation Klingon War, and the stuff we've even heard about but haven't actually seen, right? Like the Cardassian border wars and the Romulan War. Like there's a lot of, I mean, even the Klingons have been in plenty of wars too, but there's a lot of opportunities. Like, you know, somebody wants to reenact Wolf 359. Here you go. Although you may not need rules for that, really, because like the Borg just wiped the floor with everybody. So that may have been an unfair comment. But, you know, if you want to get your war on with Star Trek, you know, here's some opportunities to do that.
And I think that brings us to the end of chapter three. So we're going to jump because Aaron is here. And Aaron was kind of the brainchild behind the ship development rules in the Utopia Planitia. And one of the things that we had noticed when we were putting this together is, you know, the Star Trek Discovery campaign guide had what, 20 something new Starframes, right? Between you know, Starfleet and the Klingons. But one thing that didn't get into that book were the notable ships, like we included in Utopia Planitia. So Aaron kind of his job was to, okay, let's take these ships from the Discovery campaign guide, give them some lore so that you can add some flavor to your campaign. So Aaron, you want to dig down into some interesting things that you did with your ships? I think you also did a Starbase too, right?
Yeah, I did a few things in here. I wanted the detailed like fleet organization first. I guess that's something that I've been trying to like get into a book somewhere at some point for a while now. But I thought that we needed to have some sort of like organizational structure to Starfleet, to especially in this, to say, hey, look, I'm serving on the Klingon front. What fleet am I a part of? What part of the organization am I? And then what would be the exploration vessels? What differentiates all of these different fleets and where they serve? So I started the section with that, and then attempting to explain logistics. I know that's not exactly talking about starships, but I wanted to try to explain like how logistics is both incredibly important and not very important for story, being that the industrial might of the Federation would render most logistical chains kind of meaningless, that, you know, a planet can support all of Starfleet that we see, one single planet, and the Federation is hundreds. So, getting into the starships, though, I really wanted to write little stories as best as I could to try to detail out these starships, give them little nuggets of something that game masters can slip into their games as flavor, like Laika, the Shepherd class Laika, having putting little paw prints on her hull for ship kills. So like, hey, you see Laika come in and wow, she's got paw prints on her hull. What's that about? Oh, it's because of X, Y, and Z. And then here's the historical reference of why there's paw prints. Look it up, folks, if you don't know. But I mean, I can talk about that here too. Regardless, I loved making these little stories, even for the Klingon ships. There's little stories involved here that detail out fluff that you can put into your game.
I was looking at the Cleave ship and I laugh at the fluff that's in there. I love it. It's like the first Cleave ship that actually survived upon cleaving into another ship. Like that's so flavorful, right? Like you did a great job there, my friend. I really enjoy the flavor you put to these. And you'll notice that some of these might pop up in missions while you are playing the campaign as well. They're mm-hmm. also the assets that you will get in the tactical overlay.
Yeah. I mean, game masters and players alike, you know, read those little stories because it's a way to develop your character. I know my players in my game have a list of all the ships they've ever served on. And so giving them personality like this is something to sit around when they're in the mess hall bragging about their ships or complaining about their ships. And so, again, it's hard to be a game master and come up with a lot of details and world building constantly. Use this rich tapestry and you'll be surprised how your players, you know, riff off of it.
Yeah, it looks like this this Vulcan Science Academy research facility, Aaron, was put in here. And I think it's like part of the star system that you created as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is very cool. I thought that was a great idea. And, you know, it's cool, again, to have a home base.
I dream of a book one day, a supplement where we just have outpost stations and colonies. That would be an amazing kind of setting. You hear that, Jim? Put that on your whiteboard.
Among the many other ones. No, we've had a frontier kind of thing on my wish list for a long time now. So somehow, some way we'll, you know, give it time. We'll get to hopefully, you know, knock on wood, we'll get to everything on my wish list. That would be a heck of an achievement, I'll tell you what. but I'm curious, Al and Aaron, who can I thank for the swarm of ships sidebar? Because I thought that was great.
I think, so that was something that I submitted to, I think, the Game Master Guide, or maybe it was Utopia Planitia, but we didn't have room for it because both those books just got very, very big, very, very quickly. Okay. And I was like, all right, I need to find a way to get this in, right? Because we've got the swarmers from Voyager. You know, we've got the swarm ships from the third Abrams movie. So yeah, so it's basically just how would a civilization that just used a bunch of small shuttles, you know, tactically be useful in a ship combat. So essentially, you take the scale of all of these shuttles and make it comparable to a scale whatever ship, and whatnot. So yeah, very fun there.
I think we kicked around a lot of ideas between us, Al, on this, but yeah, it was like 90% you, I think.
Okay, well, great. Thank you both for doing that, because I know that when I was developing the when we were developing the first Discovery book, the Discovery campaign guide, I had rewatched the season two finale, you know, umpteen million times, and like, you know, you had the Federation with all the shuttles and all the pods and all the little bitty zoomers, like hundreds of them, and I was like, well, that's like a swarm of ships. And then they're all going after the Section 31 ships, and they're like, hey, Section 31, we got you outnumbered. And Control's like, look again, and like all these little tiny ships detach from the Section 31 ships, and all of a sudden there's just these gigantic swarms of ships going at each other, and you know, they're all, you know, fairly lightly powered and armored, so they're all getting blown up because it looks cool on screen, right, to see all these little flashes of stuff blowing up. And I was like, I want to know how to do that in Star Trek Adventures. I want, and make it cool and easy to manage, as opposed to just going narrative and just saying this is going to happen narratively. Like, give me some rules, you know, even though I'm not a mechanics guy or a game master, I still wanted to, like, give me the underpinning so that I could do it if I wanted to do it right. And you made it work. So this is one of my favorite bits of this book, to be honest with you.
There's one more group that it might apply to that we forgot to mention. It's the Suliban.
Yeah.
Probably do Suliban with this pretty well too.
Well, I just do want to say though, you know, for people who are thinking about that scene where all these ships flew out of Discovery's butt, is that was my first realization that Starfleet had mastered the PIM particle at some point.
Although now that I think about it, gosh, you could go, I don't know what this would look like, but like, so you're talking about like little, you know, shuttles and pods and stuff becoming a swarm. You could go to like even to the next meta level and say, you know, like the end of what was it, Picard season one, where you have the cookie cutter cut and paste hundreds of inquiry ships, right? And like that could be a swarm. And you got a swarm of, you know, Klingon Vorcha classes, and you got a swarm of Romulan Dedaredex birds of prey, and you got swarms of Cardassian Galor ships. And so you just take it to the next higher level, and instead of the swarms being just little dinky ships, you got big honking ships, and then you can have just an even bigger scale war.
So you're saying use this swarm rule if you, for instance, need a bunch of ships to go against a space station or a Borg cube. You're saying use this. Wow. I didn't even think about that. That's scary, guys. I shouldn't hear stuff like this. You know me.
All right. I'm thinking of like, was it the Vinshari in the Shackleton campaign that have just massively gigantic ships? I mean, why not? Or like the Voth, right? Aren't the Voth city ships just incredibly gigantic? So, like, you know, have a Voth city ship taken over by some renegade evil or some renegade species or something, and like the collective good guys have to team up and do it, and you got swarms of ships going after that thing. So, you know, just scale it up. I mean, hell, have what's a good example? Like, you know, do a V'ger scale thing where V'ger is just so incredibly massively huge. Who's to say V'ger didn't encounter some alien species out there that just sent wave after wave of capital ships at it, and they all got absorbed into the library?
Oh, you're scaring me.
Think big, man. Space is big. Anyway, I'll stop.
Spectacular.
No, I was about to go planetary scale. What if you could move several planets? Never mind. But I won't do that.
Well, I mean, you know, if not that I want to talk about Star Wars too much, but if your Death Star is there, and you've got you know, capital ships and fighter ships that you want to throw at it, then why not?
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that application. So that's really exciting and awe-inspiring, actually.
Terrifying.
Yeah. So, so that takes us to the end. Aaron and I did also throw together a bunch of NPCs, allies, and adversaries. Aaron, I don't know if there's any that you want to mention off the top of your head from that section that you were really excited about. But I think that people who love Star Trek are going to be really excited to see some of these characters in the NPC adversary section.
Yeah, I mean, I loved writing Commodore April in there. I thought that was, I liked that. And then, you know, he gets his promotion later on to Admiral that we see. So I don't know. I really was happy to actually write him in.
Yeah, we were definitely thinking about characters from future Star Trek and adapting them to their early years. So that was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, this was a chapter that I wish I had another 20 pages to throw you guys to. You could put even more in. Like, you did a good job. And we'll talk about this in the next episode, I think, where we talk about those tables of resources and assets that you could get and all the Easter eggs you dropped in there, characters from the original series and the movies and stuff. Because, like, you got Lieutenant Stiles in here, which is like, yeah. And then you also got Consul St. John Talbot, right, from Star Trek V. So you're pulling on that Easter egg, too. And these deep cuts, I just love these deep cuts as a Star Trek fan. And then as a game master and a player, I love seeing this stuff. And I wish we had the page count to have put even more of those in there, because I love to do that for the fans. And I'll be honest, there are times when I want to do some subversive stuff too. Like, everybody knows Stiles as the, you know, Monster Maroon captain on the Excelsior, but like, why not? It would have been so fun to commission a piece of art for him in a Discovery era uniform, like, you know, de-age his face a little bit, put him in a Discovery era uniform, and just have the cognitive dissonance of the fans go, wait a minute, that's Stiles from the Excelsior. What's he doing in that uniform? What? Oh yeah, it's all canon.
Yeah, and you know me, I love the focuses, and so I'm always scraping these for new focuses. And the Mako, you put boarding actions as a focus, like, oh, that's a good one for security, you know, any character, but especially security characters. If I saw one of my players with boarding action, I'm like, okay, well, now I'm gonna have to have them board something, you know. So I love that one.
All right. And I think that's going to bring us up to the end of today's episode. So, Michael, you want to start sending us around to do some.
Of course. You know, I'm going to say, you know, this is, you know, a new book. And with it, I'm always not only impressed with the work that goes into it, but I want to show gratitude for the people who take it and pour their hearts into it. I'm going to give gratitude actually to some people who've been posting on continuing missions lately. I want to give a thank you to Garrett Crow, who's been doing his post-play reports there on continuing missions, and also Robert Stolt, who is doing stuff with psychic aliens and Betazoids, offering mission briefs and stories like that. So again, I love that these books are inspiring people to write and sharing their creativity. So that's where my thank you goes. So why don't we go around, and why don't we do Aaron, Al, then Jim?
I guess I'm going to shout out Hoplite Games in Lansing. They're a fairly new game store, and I am really excited that they opened. That's it.
I want to, my gratitude goes to Aaron Pollier, who, no matter what time of day, if I send him a question about lore or about stats or things like that, he always gets back to me. And then we end up like going on this divergent path, talking for the next 2 hours about implications and whatnot. And it's always a ton of fun. So, Aaron, I've learned so much from you over the last few years that, you know, I truly, truly appreciate you.
Oh, well, thank you, Al. I appreciate it. I guess my youth was not misspent.
Awesome. Thanks, Al. Thanks, Aaron. I'm grateful for, honestly, it'll sound self-serving, but I'm grateful for all of you for rising to the challenge. Every time I throw a book at you or I throw an assignment at you or something, I'm always confident that something cool is going to come back at me. And you rarely fail to deliver. Like sometimes I might have a couple notes just to make a couple tweaks, and then you guys are off and running, adding even more cool stuff to it. So I'm grateful to all of you and to all the writers who worked on this book and all the writers who've worked on all the other books, but especially since we're talking about this one, the big cast of characters, the big cast of writers that we had working on this one. Great job. I tell you, these tools, even though I may not use them in all my games, I appreciate that they're there. You know, it's like, I was watching, this is a digression, but bear with me. I was watching a TikTok of a mechanic who was fixing a car, right? And it was really, if you look at it, it's kind of mundane. Like he's fixing an oil, you know, he's doing an oil change, but he's the way he was doing it was so meticulous. He would explain what he needed. He would go to his toolbox, and his toolbox was like a beautiful toolbox. Every tool perfectly arranged and in exactly the spot where it needs to be. He would grab the exact tool he needed, make the fix, put the tool right back where it belonged, and go on to the next thing. And I appreciated that attention to detail. And I appreciated that all those tools were there if he needed them. Right. And so as a game master, you know, in enjoying a game system that is now 8 years robust, we're still finding new tools to put into the toolbox. Right. I just love that. I cannot get enough of that. So thanks. My appreciation for all of you. Thank you for continuing to add to the STA toolbox, because this just gets better and better every product we bring out. I'm so excited because I can't wait for the fans to do something with this and do something cool with it and go fill up continuing mission with more stuff. So thank you all. And of course, thank you to the fans. Thank you to the fans for finding this stuff and using this stuff and sharing what you're doing with it. So really cool. So thanks all of you. As always, we wouldn't be doing this game without you. So we're here for you, and we're grateful that you're here for us. So thanks.
All right. So everyone tune in. Thank you, Al. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Jim. And tune in as the conversation continues next week when we get to my favorite show, I think is going to be of this series. And it's about the campaign rules. Get ready to drool, people, and hear about what really makes this tactical campaign take off. Until next time, IDIC.
Live long and prosper. Be safe. Be well. We'll talk to you all next time.